Not so very long ago, at least for most people in the world, your work was your life. It was about surviving and, if you were lucky enough, creating and sustaining a family so that you had something to leave to the future. Very few had the luxury of thinking about the deeper significance of their work because the body made clear what work needed to be done. It was a sun-up to sun-down project. Of course, that is still true for at least a billion people on the planet that are living subsistence lives. But even for those of us in the developed world, it was true not so long ago. And I think about my own family, and I realize that I am at most three generations removed from the need to grow my own food and make my own clothes, the way my great-grandparents did in rural Michigan or on the plains of Kansas or New Mexico. One of my great-grandparents was a Presbyterian minister, but he was also a hardscrabble farmer. Another was a soldier in the Union Army and a homesteader. By my grandparents' era, careers had become more specialized. They were a homemaker, a builder, a rural doctor, and a nurse. My dad was the first on his side of the family to be college educated. He started work in a foundry and he rose to become an engineering executive at GM during the golden years of American manufacturing. The 57 Chevy was my dad's claim to fame. There's a book on it, actually. Thanks to my parents, my brother and sister and I were able to go to college and were what you might call knowledge workers. None of us ever worked the land or the lines. Our kids have almost all gone on to graduate school, and most are working in information-based professions. So this story tracks pretty closely to the story of at least part of the American middle class, moving from mostly agricultural work to manufacturing, then professional work, and on to information-age jobs. For each succeeding generation, this progression has opened up more opportunities. You know, choices that my great-grandparents could not even have conceived of. But it's also created many ways of working that are no longer directly related to our living. Like everything else, it's a double-edged sword. If you're aware of your gifts and passions and you can see the possibilities for applying them, and if you're fortunate enough to get the education and training you need, you have tremendous opportunities to find work that nourishes you. But if you don't have those things, if you lack access to education, or you have to leave school or leave a job you love because you got to take care of someone else, you have an ever greater risk of making a living doing things that have nothing to do with what really matters in your life. Restoring that relationship between our work and our larger sense of significance has never been more complicated, and I don't think it's been more urgent. Now, imagine that you're 18. For me, that's a little bit of a stretch. But you get out your iPhone and you search Yahoo News or you look up the blogs on career advice and you find endless lists of the hot jobs of tomorrow. You can learn which college degrees are the best value as measured by lifetime earnings potential. For every conceivable entry-level job, you can calculate just how many years it will take to pay back all those college loans. And the unambiguous message in all of that is that work is about the money. The Episcopal priest and author Michael Fox says, "The ultimate gift that adults pass on to the young, after all, is a sense of values. And the primary value in life is not in the things we buy with the money we earn. The primary value in life is in living life fully." Since I have made the somewhat crazy move from being a corporate executive to being a minister working in human rights, people often want to ask me why on the earth I would do that. They're usually polite about it, but the subtext question is, why would you walk away from the money at age 47? Well, one of the honest answers is because I could, and that placed me in an incredibly privileged position. But the more important and truthful answer is because I felt called. And You know, when I say called, I don't mean that God rang me up one day. I've never had that phone plan. Think about the roaming charges. But for me, it's more like a deep-seated awareness of who I am and what I'm meant to do. And occasionally I get to glimpse that, but it will not leave me alone. It compels me to spend more of my waking hours doing this crazy work of ministry. And what's more, it's been there all along. You know, my understanding of it has gotten more refined over time. At different points, I've tried to ignore it, and I put it aside for good economic reasons, and I've tried different variations on the theme. If you'd asked me at 18 to describe how this was all going to play out, I would not have had a guess. It's only in retrospect that all this divergent worst choices I've made have made any sense, but it is clear that I've been responding to the same call the whole time. In most of our congregations, we offer an adult religious course called Building Your Own Theology. The purpose of the course is to explore what we believe about the really big questions and the implications they have for us. In my experience teaching the course, the first thing that happens, because we're all UUs, is we want to name all the different religious ideas that we can identify with. I might identify with ethical Christianity and humanism and religious naturalism. Somebody else might describe themselves as a Buddhist agnostic. You know, it's amazing the variety that you hear. But then we push a little deeper and we start asking people to explore their own beliefs about cosmology and ethos. You know, cosmology meaning how the world works, and ethos meaning, therefore, what really matters. And something amazing happens when we get into that conversation. Regardless of the diversity of beliefs we hold about the existence and nature of God, UUs pretty quickly converge on the idea that the way the world actually works is revealed to us by science. Together, we stand in awe of this beautiful, infinite, complex, downright miraculous world that we inhabit. We understand that we're an integral part of it and essential agents in its evolution. We have both the capability and the obligation to further the larger life of which we are a part. Brian Swim calls this the great work of the universe. The idea that we are uniquely empowered to create a better present world for ourselves and for the rest of life, it's a very heart of our UU theology, and it underlies all the seven principles. Then, finally comes the hardest part. Given the seven understanding of how the world works and what really matters, we ask ourselves, what are my special gifts and passions? What's my personal sense of purpose? What is my obligation to the rest of life? And that's where the theology becomes our own. For every one of us, the answer is going to be different. It will reveal itself in different ways. For many of us, discerning our calling is going to be a lifelong process because it's about melding talent and passion with opportunity, with a little bit of courage. And those all unfold on different timetables. With all due respect to Henry Moore and his quote this morning, I don't know anybody who can honestly say that they devote every minute of every day for their whole lives to one central task. But I'm happy for Henry if that were the case. For some people, a sense of calling arises in the form of an idea or an image that they just cannot shake. Maybe it's the words of an inspiring person or a chance meeting that moves them to their life's calling from out of the blue. For others, it's a sense of providence. I think of that as consciousness being interrupted by the unconscious in a way that feels directional. Emerson believed that since each of us bears the spark of the divine, the answers are contained within. Our task is to apply that immanent sense of all being and pay close attention. For me, it's been a series of experiences along an improbable path. Ever since I participated in some church outreach projects in rural Colorado in high school, and I learned that I could actually make a difference for somebody else, I wanted to do social justice ministry. But my work life took a lot of twists and turns. And among other things, I worked as a janitor on the night shift. I've been a desk clerk and night auditor at the Roadway Inn. Fine location. I was a publications manager. I spent a summer working as an accountant, reconciling used equipment inventories, which was chasing down thousands of used parts from commercial television equipment that was in dusty warehouses. The only good news is it was in the Bay Area in California. I worked as a hospital administrator, as an intern. And then I spent a couple of decades at PepsiCo selling Cheetos and orange juice. And just to illustrate my different work identities, I am wearing this morning my Frito-Lay tie. And some of you are probably trying to squint and say, what is that he's wearing? And it's quite something to behold. It has, there's a basket of potatoes, an ear of corn, salt shaker, you know, Doritos, Ruffles, Cheetos, Roll Gold, you name it. It's pretty hideous, really. I have a Tropicana one that has a carton and it has juice flowing all the way down the tie. And I couldn't even put it on this morning, although I thought about it. I can't say that any of these were my life's work, but they all taught me something about it. You know, as a janitor, I learned that you can have as much pride in a beautifully waxed floor as in a boardroom presentation. You really can. I also learned what it feels like to be in a job where you are almost completely invisible. Working as a janitor on the night shift is one of those. Being a hotel night auditor taught me that what people do in hotels in the middle of the night can be endlessly surprising. It was a frontline lesson in human behavior. From the accounting job, I learned how to operate a 10-key calculator by touch, and I learned at the very deepest level that I did not want to be an accountant. And from my years at PepsiCo, I actually learned that a diversely talented group of people, when they have a shared purpose and they have enough generosity of spirit to trust one another, can do some amazing things. For me, mapping out these experiences and the moments of insight and sort of the pivotal decisions that I made along the way and then connecting the dots and drawing the line out has given me a sense of what my life's work is meant to be. But it's not the only way. And so to cast a wider net, I invited the church members to send me descriptions of their life's work and how they discovered it. And I received 14 responses, and they were remarkable. The largest number came from educators. 6 people described their work as life's work as teaching. I don't know why, but I think maybe it's because teachers feel a need to turn in their assignments. I mean, I know Dick didn't really have anything to say, and he wrote me. He said, "You need me to say something." I was like, "No, I'm good. I'm good. I've got it covered." June Brascala, Sue Sherman, Shirley Foss, Nancy Janice, Nancy Richardson, and Nancy Thomas. There's a Nancy thing happening here. All wrote about the joy of making a transformative difference in the lives of young people. And most talked about a particular moment when they realized it was what they were meant to do. I wish I could read all of them, but I want to share Nancy Thomas's, which I think is pretty representative. Nancy was married with a husband who was attending Harvard Business School, a young mother getting ready to start a master's program in social work at Boston University. But then she says, "The faith intervened and changed my destiny." Through her UU church in Newton, Massachusetts, Nancy signed up to volunteer at a Title 20 Model Cities childcare program in Cambridge. She can't fathom why she did this, because she had 3 little kids at home and she was teaching RE on Sundays. But on the first day in Cambridge, she met a 4-year-old boy who captivated her. She says, "It was definitely not because of his attention to the teachers, nor his appropriate behavior. It was, however, evident that this child was alert, curious, active, engaged, although not necessarily in the desired ways. And the longer I watched him, the more intrigued I became. By the end of the morning, I knew what my life's work was meant to be. And the next day, I withdrew from BU and applied to Wheelock College for their master's program in early childhood education. That became my life's work for the next 34 years professionally and as a volunteer for the last 10. The next largest respondent group was people whose life work is about caring for others, whether geriatric counseling for the elderly and their families, in the case of Kay Dyer, or helping people lead happier lives, as Pat Halpern does through clinical social work and pet therapy, or David Ryan's ever-broadening understanding of ministry, or Jody McBrien's research work with war-affected women and children. Jody says that working with refugees gave her the greatest joy, but people often ask how she can do it because it must be depressing. She says, "I wish the world were such that my job would not be available. But the people I have worked with, those determined to make a better life for themselves and their children, teach me profoundly wise lessons in love and forgiveness." I think those of you who have worked with people in crisis know exactly what she means by that. Two people describe their life's work as caregiving for the planet and the species with whom we share it. Ava Whaley says her life's work is to reduce the number of unwanted pets so that people who care for dogs and cats treat them like the precious creatures that they are. And Ward Pallotta may be a mild-mannered tax preparer by profession, but his life's work is promoting the health of people and the environment by promoting healthy, sustainable food and a food system. He says, "I live it, believe it, study it, advocate for it, and regularly share it with others." I guess that's a pretty good working definition of a life's work. Bob Waite described his life's work this way: "I spent most of my career in corporate life. Although successful in reaching heights I could not have imagined, when retirement came, I knew I wanted to do something else. I had considered a writing career early in life, but because my spelling was terrible, I was told I could never succeed as a writer. When I retired, however, spell check had come on the scene. I promptly dove into writing and never looked back." Finally, our friend Jack Scherer wrote in from across the pond. I'm not entirely sure what he was trying to say about his life's work, but I know it had something to do with friends and neighbors and wine. As I read through all these stories, it became clear, with the possible exception of Jack, that all of these folks felt a pretty specific sense of their own calling. For many, their life's work was also what they did for a living, but not for everybody. In most cases, finding their life's work was a discovery process that unfolded over time as they experienced themselves in new and different situations. Some had an out-of-the-blue sense of calling. Many others felt a sense of providence, of being guided on the course of their life's work. But as I reflected on all this, I was struck by a larger commonality. These deeper callings, you know, the things that people are willing to say are their life's work, are all, in one way or another, about the furtherance of life. Some wrote about opening up possibilities for young people or helping others find strength and hope. Others wrote about artistic expression that enlarges understanding. Some wrote about raising up a family or supporting their friends. And still others were called to nurture the rest of life on the planet. It made me think that maybe our most compelling and fulfilling work really does connect us in some way the world really works, and therefore what really matters. The great work of life in the universe. The economist E.F. Shoemaker observed that if we teach one another that we are the outcome of nothing but utilitarianism, we only come to a utilitarian idea of work. In that case, the less of it, the better. If, however, we can place work in its cosmological context, it becomes our pleasure and joy. It's plentiful. It's abundant. It is everywhere in the universe. As work grows more alienated from life, maybe our task is to help the next generations appreciate the difference between making a living and living life fully. Maybe we can help one another discern the work to which each of us is called that serves the furtherance of life. Maybe it falls to us to show how we can become more spiritually whole by working for a more humane present world and by heeding that insistent call of the universe that beckons us forward. In the words of that wonderful Shaker hymn that we sang this morning, perhaps when it comes to our life's work, it is a gift to be simple. It's a gift to be free. It's a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight.